on the bank, spitting from a bridge, just to see how far down it really is. Robbing a bank, jumping on a train, old antiques a man alone can entertain. Takes all your power, prove that you don't care.
The Letters, Sportsnet's Blue Jays podcast with Arden Zwelling and Ben Nicholson Smith.
Yeah! It's At the Letters for Wednesday, May 25th on Sportsnet.ca and on iTunes. My name is Arden Zwelling, and as always, I am joined by my co-host Ben Nicholson Smith. Ben, what's going on today, my friend?
Not too much.
You have a new blue Tim Hortons cup in front of you. Look at this thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Is it camp day today? Are we on camp day?
I think we're on camp day, but I've seen these cups for a while.
We're in the lead up to camp.
After roll up the rim, I stop examining the cups so closely. So I have to admit, I didn't even notice that it was a blue cup.
It's eye-catching.
Yeah.
It's eye-catching. That's what we're that desperate for things to talk about here because, geez, what are we going to talk about? The Toronto Blue Jays lost 6-0 last night to the New York Yankees. A truly demoralizing, disheartening loss if I've ever seen one. The Blue Jays, only the second time this year they've been shut out. Only the second time, which is like, it's interesting because they've really been failing to score runs.
Yeah.
But that wasn't good.
I think their offense has been more mediocre to below average than it has been totally disastrous. I mean, you look at the run scored, right? You look at any kind of offensive metric. They're in that 15 to 20 range of Major League Baseball, which is definitely below average and way below expectations, but it's not zero runs a night.
That's fair. That's fair. As I quickly scramble to look it up, I bet you the Blue Jays are a top half run score. Oh, they're 16th. So they're like right in terms of run score, they're average. They're just average. And that's why they're kind of been hovering around 500 all year, because they're just an average team.
Right. Well, really? The way they're playing, they have.
Yeah. Or they've been playing like an average team.
Yeah.
But at what point does a team that's playing like an average team become just an average team?
Yeah, exactly. I think it's not so far in the future. You know, it's not like we have to wait another few months. I think we'll know essentially maybe in a month from now what this team is. I think we're getting closer to knowing what they are. And I think it's already safe to say that the offensively dominant group that we saw all of last year has kind of disappeared.
Here's my thing with this. So like you know, and it's totally correct that there's still a lot of games to be played. There's still, I can't do the math. It's probably like 115 or something like that. Like there's still a lot of games to be played. But the Toronto Blue Jays need to make a decision about what they are come probably the end of June. Because at that point, that's when you kind of start preparing for what you're going to do in July, which is, you know, the trade deadline's July 31st.
I guess I would dispute that.
Would you?
I think that they can wait until the end of July.
No, because you got to make trades if you're going to make trades. Like you've got two very large expiring contracts that, I mean, you could qualify them and get a draft pick, but wouldn't you rather get something else?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Which is why.
So you can't wait till the 31st of July.
I think you can wait. And the trade deadline this year is August 1st, which gives them one more day.
So you're right. You win.
But hey, I think that. If you wait until July 25th, okay?
Yeah.
That gives you 5 days. Do you know how much MLB front offices work around the clock? They can get so much done in 5 days. You wrote the story last year about Anthopoulos phoning up Jack Cerenzik at what time in the morning?
Oh, yeah,
it's not
absolutely.
Like these guys are sleeping. They have 24 hours a day to get trade talks advanced.
Part of that story as well, though, was that those, you know, Alex Anthopoulos had been calling about David Price for a month. You know what I mean? Like they've been talking about Troy Tulowitzki since the previous offseason, right? Like they'd been, you know, the seeds of that were sown long, long, long ago. They were planted well long ago. And then, you know, all of a sudden in the last week, July, beautiful flowers grew.
There you go. Yeah.
But I think that so there is some preparation and planning that has to go into this before that last week,
which is already beginning.
So do you think that they've created two kind of plans where it's we're going all in plan and we're not going all in plan, and they've called to examine with other teams what they could do?
I think it would be totally irresponsible not to. Right. I would be stunned if they don't do that. And whether they've placed calls on that front, I don't know. But I think you absolutely have to consider, okay, what if they have a couple injuries and they play below their potential and they're clearly out of it. You have to be ready for that. What if they want to add and subtract at the same time, the way we've seen the A's do in the past? You know, you trade away Cespedes and you get a Lester. What if they want to completely add and they're going to try to revamp their bullpen on the fly? I mean, there are a few different possibilities. I think all of those they have to consider.
Add and subtract is so difficult to pull off.
And yet I wonder if they would look at that.
Really?
Yeah.
That'd be interesting. I think you subtract an Edwin Encarnacion and add somebody who has another year of control next year. Yeah.
You wonder.
Yeah, maybe. And I also, like, I've never worked in an MLB front office, but I also, like, I feel like it'd be weird to pick up the phone and call somebody and be like, okay, so is this guy, what would it take to this guy? Is this guy available with that guy? Would you think about trading that guy? And then a week later, it'd be like, no, we're selling now.
Right? Like, right.
You know, who knows? I think you're right. I think they probably have done that due diligence, or at least they're working to. It probably, like, right now, I don't know what kind of realistic conversations you could have. But yeah, you know, I think, but regardless, it's not those last 2 months. I guess the point I was trying to make is the 60 odd games those last 2 months. You can't count those in there's a lot of games left, because you have to make a decision before then.
Right.
So, you know, we can bicker about the date. Say it's, you know, the All-Star break, right? By the All-Star break, the Blue Jays should know. You know,
I think you wait until after.
There's like 2 weeks after the All-Star break until
that's my exact point. That's a long time.
All right. Either way, the point is...
Sorry. I keep derailing your point here.
The point is that, yeah, there's not, you know, they do have to kind of figure it out. So we're almost through May, you know, like probably 7 games left in May. I mean, we're almost through this. Interesting. Hey, this is ATL. We didn't intro anything. We're going to have Dave Cameron on later. I'm not going to be here for that conversation because I am moving today. And you know what's a real pain in the ass?
What's that?
Moving.
Oh,
real pain in the ass.
Wow.
So I have to step out for that. So my apologies to Dave Cameron, who's a great guy and who I like a lot. So, but Ben's going to interview him. We'll talk about a lot of things. Hey, Devin Travis is coming back. That's good. He's in Buffalo right now. He's been doing well. Making some hard contact. Ben Wagner has been providing basically live tweets of his at-bats on Twitter. A very, very invaluable service. Need that in our lives. What happens when Devin Travis comes back? And actually, I hate that question. I hate that I asked it, so I rescind it. I take it back, because I get that all day. Like, what happens when he comes back? I don't know. Ryan Goins might get hurt tomorrow, right? So we don't know.
Right.
But the Blue Jays do have a decision looming when Devin Travis comes back. To me, it's more interesting where Devin Travis slots into the batting order when he comes back. Do you start him near the bottom, take a little pressure off him? Do you put him right back into leadoff? Do you screw around with, you know, the new look batting order with Jose Bautista leading off? You know, the Blue Jays want, you know, they won 3-4 in Minnesota with it, but it's not like they were scoring a lot of runs. How do you see this playing out?
Yeah, and I think you're right to say that there are two pretty big questions here. And starting with the question of where Travis hits in the order, I think, and you would have a better sense of this having been around the team in Minnesota when they made this change, but I think that the Bautista at leadoff is more of a, hey, we'll see, we need something, we've got to try something out here, than it is a, we're going to do this for the next 4 months.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised to see them move away from it, especially because it really hasn't done a lot for them offensively. Like, they've basically been the same offensive club since they made that change.
And Travis is the kind of guy who is pretty good as a leadoff hitter, because he will get on base and you're not, quote unquote, wasting home runs. I mean, that's why you don't put your ultimate power bat in the leadoff spot, is because one quarter of his at-bats, he's going to come up with no one on. So if in Travis's case, that's fine, because he's not really a huge power guy, even though he did hit 8 home runs last year.
It's true. Jose Bautista's been hitting home runs out of that spot with men on base. He's, you know what I mean? Like, he had the 2-run shot. He had the 3-run shot. Like, after the first time through, it doesn't matter. But I do kind of see the argument of, like, well, let's try to control the one rotation through the batting. You know what I mean? The one inning you can control is the first inning. And after that, you can't. So let's at least try to control what happens to that inning. I also like having, like, 3 guys who can leave the park coming up right off the bat.
Oh, it's got to be such a rough beginning to the game. If you're an opposing pitcher and you're like, oh man, I wonder who the Jays have out there. Maybe, you know, Darwin Barney's leading off, or Pilar or something. No, Bautista, Donaldson, and Encarnacion. I mean, that's a rough way to start your day.
Absolutely. I think that as things stand right now, you would have to look at Ryan Goins as a candidate to be optioned when Devin Travis comes back. I doubt you would disagree with me on that one.
I would completely agree with you on that one. And I think the Jays tipped their hand a little bit by playing Barney against right-handed pitchers twice in a row.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that kind of says where, and like Ryan Goins is in a deep, deep, deep slump. Like I'm scrambling to look it up right now.
He's hitting 100 in May. His OPS is under 400.
In his last 32 games, we're talking about 93 plate appearances, 8 hits. 8 hits in his last 93 plate appearances. That is a .092 batting average. That is a .323 OPS. That is not major league rosterable.
Yeah, so I would be very surprised if Goins is an option when Travis returns. Also because Barney's a better bench piece.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Darren Barney's shown some power.
Yeah.
He's shown a little bit of pop. And like it's small, whatever, but like, hey, he's looked good in his appearances. And if a guy, every time you put him in the lineup, seems to do something good for you, I mean, why you got to reward that at some point instead of, you know, denigrating him for being a small sample size.
And the other option that you would have would be to remove Jimmy Paredes from the roster, but he's looked good. He's out of options. You have to think that after what he showed in Minnesota, he's probably earned some chances to stick around.
Yeah, probably. He's kind of like, he's Chris Colabello now, basically, right? Except like he doesn't have a position. He plays a lot of positions poorly. It's the thing that Jimmy Paredes does.
Yeah, he's a great DH.
Yeah, he's a great DH, right? So yeah, I mean, you know, he's Chris Colabello and like whatever. Like I like the guy. Like I talked to him a bit in Minnesota. Like he's a, you know, laid back dude. Like, you know, clearly understands hitting, understands the game. He's been through a lot in his career. Like he doesn't find, you know, a home because it's just, you know, it's a good hit tool, but it's not good enough that you want to take him on as your everyday DH. And then right. To be a bench player without a position is a tough thing to do.
Yeah. No, it definitely is, especially in the American League where you don't have as many bench spots. And usually you're looking at, you need someone who can play shortstop, someone who can play center, and someone who can catch. That basically leaves one spot for a bat.
Right. That's true. What about these bats, Ben? What about them? They're not working. Here's the thing about baseball. You got to score runs.
Yeah.
Blue Jays, revolutionary, saying, no, we're not going to do that stuff. And like, what I struggle with is that there's no solution. You know what I mean? They rejuggled the batting order. Like they did everything. Like there's nothing else you can do except just go with it.
You got to wait it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then what if it never comes?
Then you have to hope the pitching holds up.
Right. But we've seen over these first X amount of games that even with really, really, you know, arguably like elite starting pitching, that it's not enough without the bats.
Yeah, and that's where the bullpen comes in. You need better bullpen work. I think Chavez's struggles have to be a concern of late. Obviously, you look at a guy like Storen, who hasn't put it together all year. Cecil, who's out for a month. I mean, all those things start to add up, and the bullpen looks clearly below average right now. But, I mean, the main question remains the offense, and Tulowitzki is showing signs of putting it together a little bit. Russell Martin still is not hitting for power, and Kevin Pillar's in a slump. I mean, you're just looking at an offense that as a group is continuing to fall well below expectations.
You mentioned Jesse Chavez, and I quickly popped up his baseball reference page. And yes, you're right. He is struggling quite a bit lately. And it's weird because every time, like I find when you talk to Jesse Chavez, like he knows so much about pitching and he's such a resource really to go to and ask about, you know, throwing cutters or throwing sliders, different things pitchers will try to do. But yeah, I mean, over his last three outings, we're looking at 4 earned runs. And that's just in an inning and 2/3.
And look at the strikeout to walk too.
Yeah, that's not good. Oh yeah, 2 walks yesterday, and then yeah, no strikeouts. He's got 1 strikeout in his last 5 outings.
In the season, he had 16 strikeouts to I think 2 walks. So he was really good from a strikeout to walk perspective early. His velocity has stayed the same, but he's just not getting the swings and misses. So I don't know what's going on there. You never want to overreact to a sample of a few games, but clearly, Chavez is not pitching well right now, and he's one of those guys, along with Gavin Floyd, along with Joe Biagini, who was supposed to step into that gap created by the initial struggles of Storen and Cecil.
Yeah, the second wave now is struggling, right? Because, you know, when you look at, Roberto, if you're John Gibbons and you're looking at your bullpen and you're trying to manage late in games, you say, all right, I want to get the ball to Roberto Osuna. Who have I got to get there? Well, Brett Cecil's on the DL. Drew Storen, I can't trust for anything. Gavin Floyd's really, really good against lefties. Gave up a very untimely home run with some very strange pitch selection the other day in Minnesota. But he's been all right. Now I can't really use Jesse Chavez because he's not striking anybody out, not missing any bats. Chad Girodo has, you know, been in the minors for his entire career. Joe Biagini emerges as like this strange, large, eccentric, trustworthy option in the bullpen.
Isn't that nuts? And he has been good. And of course they have to go to him. But again, I mean, it's 15 innings, right? I don't know how much to believe this.
They're going to go to him in higher leverage spots.
Sure.
That's what they're going to do.
Yeah.
And it's like right now in the Blue Jays bullpen, it's a who wants the opportunity? Oh. Who wants to show us that we can trust you?
Oh, I'm not saying there's a better option. But, you know, you look at, it's not like he's striking everyone out. I mean, and Biagini's doing a good job. And, you know, when you're throwing 95 with that kind of a curveball, he looks legit. And he's throwing a lot of strikes and doesn't seem phased at all by the big stage. That pickoff move the other day was, I think, an example, as you wrote about, of Biagini's poise on the mound.
Composure.
Yeah.
That's what you think of when you think of Joe Biagini. just really well put together.
It's on the mound that counts, right?
And that's what I talked to Pete Walker about it. And like we had a funny conversation about like, yeah, this guy is like he's a different duck. But once like Pete Walker's point was like, yeah, like he's definitely weird in the bullpen and everything and just be around. But then once he gets on the field, it's like ultimate tunnel vision. He says he locks in on the task at hand, unlike anybody else. Like it's just pure tunnel vision.
Yeah.
And he says that's what helps make him really good.
Right. To the extent that you can see that kind of thing from the TV screen or from the press box, I think it certainly seems like he's locked in, right? Like you look at his facial expression, it doesn't change. Like when he's pitching, it is very constant. He's very, seems to be just zoned in and the results obviously are working.
I don't know if I've made this point on this podcast yet, but like this is my Biagini point is like, I don't think he realizes the pressure or like he just doesn't feel it when he's out there, right? Like he just doesn't even, it doesn't occur to him. And I don't mean that in a, he's able to block it out or, you know, he doesn't want to think about the pressure. It just doesn't occur to him that like, oh, hey, like, you know, 50,000 people are going to be really mad at me if I screw this up. Like he doesn't think about it.
And I think to some extent he's playing with found money. If you're a Rule 5 pick and you get to spring training and you're like honestly, one of the things that stood out to Biagini when he got to spring training was that the pants fit. Like, just little things like that. He's like, oh, the food is great. My clothing fits. Like, these are the kind of things that just made his life better as a Blue Jay. And now that he's actually succeeding, got his first save, got his first win, ERA in the zeros, I think that's almost a bonus.
Oh, hey, we take a plane to games? Like, we fly?
Where's what? The bus? Where's the Greyhound station?
Where do I carry my bag to? Oh, right. What, you mean I don't have to carry it?
It just arrives in my room?
Yeah, it just shows up. What's this big envelope of money I get every day on the road? What's that about? Per diem? What's this?
Yeah.
It's a good life. So here's the thing. Quickly looking at it, they're only twice this year. So you were saying he's made 13 appearances. Only twice have they been when the Blue Jays have been ahead or tied. And those were both in extra innings. Most of the time it's been, you know, you look through it and you see down 10, down 6, down 4, down 3, down 4, down 3. So he hasn't seen those, you know, we just don't know about the higher leverage spots. Like he was great in that save in Minnesota, but I mean, you know, it's not like John Gibbons designed it that it was going to come to Joe Biagini for the save in the bottom of the 11th. Use Roberto Osuna for 2 innings.
Yeah.
It's another thing we're starting to see the Blue Jays do. Use Roberto Osuna for more innings because who the hell else are you going to, like, you know what I mean? Like, oh my, like, it's almost at the point now where, like, it's, you know, if you need 5 outs, you got a 1-run lead. Like, that's the only guy you can really trust.
Yeah. And I think, too, say you have 5 to 10 outings a year that you're comfortable going to Osuna for more than 3 outs. Well, this is probably the time to get those outings out of him because later in the year, you're going to have Aaron Sanchez.
True.
And there's some chance that if the Blue Jays can stay in this thing, well, I think it's safe to say their number one priority on the trade market would be relief help.
Right.
That seems obvious to me.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And so at that point, you maybe add a reliever and then you add Sanchez and Osuna can return to that 1-inning role.
Right. Because that's, you know, your options really when you have no one else to trust is either use Osuna for multiple innings, and you're right, this would be a good time to do it. You ask your starters to go deeper into games. They've already been going pretty deep, but like you try to get, you know, you ratchet up those pitch counts to like 110 and you put them in positions where their stuff's less effective and you're putting more mileage on their arms throughout the season. And, you know, you put them in positions to, you know, take losses, which pitchers don't like. Like I think loss starting pitchers when they, you know, no one ever wants to come out of the game, but a lot of them, you know, are happy to come out and have somebody come in and strand their inherited runners and they get to preserve their win. And or so you can do that, or you could just say, screw the closer's rule. you know, if it's the seventh inning or the eighth inning, we got runners on. And that's where a lot of the Blue Jays bullpen troubles have come, when there's runners on. They do fine with clean innings for the most part. Let's, you know, bring in Roberto Osuna to get those outs with runners on, and then get a clean ninth for Gavin Floyd or for whoever, and just say screw saves. Like, we're, you know, we're going to have, you know, three or four guys on this team finish with eight or nine saves. Who cares? Let's work this thing backwards, because we can't keep losing games in the seventh and eighth inning.
It's not crazy. It's not crazy. And I think that there's a very strong case to be made for that. At the same time, could you see John Gibbons doing that?
No.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't see it.
Desperate times, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Could I see, you know, if I sat here last week and you said, could you see John Gibbons leading off Jose Bautista?
Yeah.
I'd be like, no.
Right.
Could I? And if you asked me, could you see Jose Bautista being so okay with that to the point that he brings the idea to John Gibbons? I would say no. But that's what happened.
No, it's true. And so maybe at a certain point you say, all right, we need these outs. This is the time we need them. And then you roll the dice in those later innings. Maybe you play matchups and try to patch your way through a ninth inning situation like that. So, right, at this point in the season, they've got to get some wins, right? Like, you can't just wait around and assume that the wins are going to come your way. You got to go out and make them happen. And that doesn't mean sack bunts. That doesn't mean hit and run all the time. But it maybe means being a little bit open-minded about solutions that you wouldn't have considered earlier in the season.
Just don't see a lot of other options.
You know, yeah,
it's kind of the theme of this Toronto Blue Jays season. Not a lot of options.
Yeah. Yeah, they could use it, they could really use like a dominant relief prospect at AAA or something like that.
Are we missing anything? Do we want to talk about the Donaldson stuff getting hit or no? It's up to you.
What do you think? So you were there. You talked
yeah,
to him.
I was there.
You talked to him. So
I started that conversation.
Josh Donaldson, well, depending on who you ask, maybe the Minnesota Twins in the dugout started that. Or maybe the umpire did. But what do you think about where Phil Hughes located those pitches on either side of Josh Donaldson and the whole ensuing discussion with the Twins?
I mean, I am not in favor of beanballs or of, you know, throwing at guys intentionally. I think it's silly. I think it's dumb, especially when it's over like something between Donaldson and the Twins coaching staff. And that was kind of JD's point, like in a lot of what he was saying, was like, I'm not mad at Phil Hughes. Like, they told him to throw at me. It was their coaching staff, and it, you know what I mean? Like, it was their bench coach that I, you know, that was chirping me the day before, and then I looked at him the next day, and now all of a sudden I'm dodging fastballs. Like, it's like, I don't know, it's this like tired discussion we've had about baseball over and over again, and about the unwritten rules and about all the nonsense that goes on. And, you know, I think that to a point, you know, if it's something the players want in the game, it's something the players want happening, then fine. Like, it's, you guys are playing, it's your game. You can play it however you want to. When you have the defending MVP coming out and saying, no, this is garbage, like, this is bull, you know what I mean? Like, this is stupid. I don't understand it. It doesn't make any sense to me logically. That's, to me, changes the conversation a little bit.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. It's not as though these players are defending the code and saying this is the way it should be. It's fine. We'll sort it out on the field. Donaldson is saying this is silly. You know, this is just passing the point where it makes a lot of sense for Major League Baseball, because if you have stars who are out of the game because they've been hit by a pitch, like we've seen with Stanton, or like we could see with someone like Donaldson if he keeps getting thrown at, then you're playing essentially replacement-level players in their place.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's something Josh has been thinking about for a while, I think. Because I was kind of telling you earlier, I just came over to have an off-the-record chat with him, and he just started like, you know what I mean? Like, very angrily stating all of these things. And I was like, whoa, like, let me get my recorder out here. It's gold, Jerry.
Yeah.
But like, you know, I mean, it's clearly something that's been weighing on him a lot, and something that's been following the Blue Jays around quite a bit. You know, the Blue Jays are now like this hated team, I guess.
Yeah. Do you get that sense? Because, you know, Jose Bautista, not the most popular player among players in Major League Baseball.
I think that Josh Donaldson and Jose Bautista are tough players to play against because they play very hard. They're very emotional guys, and I don't think that they're easy to, you know, see, you know, to play against, really. But as Josh Donaldson said, as my opponent, you're not supposed to like me. I'm not supposed to make things comfortable for you. You know what I mean? Like, you're supposed to be like upset and annoyed with what I'm doing.
And David Price has made that point too. And this is where I'm sure guys who play alongside Bautista and Donaldson say, wow, I mean, they're incredible hitters. They're hard workers. So that's most of what you'd want in a teammate. And David Price has kind of made that point where from across the field, you might have a very different perception of them. But other players, they don't see these guys on a day-to-day level. They're directly in opposition to them, And so they're not necessarily going to like watching them argue balls and strikes, for example.
It's just kind of, I think, you know, against the spirit of sport to just be like, oh, you know, that guy's not playing the game the right way. We need to discipline him. Or, you know, oh, this guy, you know, is hitting too many home runs off us, or he looked in our dugout, or this or that. Like, it's like, use the game to shut him up. Get him out, you know, like, be better.
Yeah.
Beat him, you know, like, win the game, you know, like, like, that's the ultimate revenge. It's not throwing fastballs at people, right? It's competition, right? And, like, if people want to be intense competitors, and, it doesn't make sense to me, really, right? That, like, you know, you can have, like, fans in the stands who, like, who yell things and taunt and chirp, and, like, when the Blue Jays score, you know, hit a home run, they can go crazy and jump up and down and spill their beer and go nuts. But the guy who's actually playing the game and the guy who actually hits the home run, he can't yell, he can't celebrate, he can't do any, you know what I mean? Like, he can't display any kind of outward emotion while there's 50,000 people around him displaying, like, ultimate emotion over this amazing thing he just did. The guy who actually performed the act doesn't get to. That doesn't just logically make any sense to me. I think it's just against, like, you know, what sport is, that you can't, you know, if you can't compete intensely and with emotion, like, why would you be against that?
Even look at any kind of promotional material from Major League Baseball, from the NBA, from the NFL. They show emotion. They show highlights and they show emotion. So it's part of it's the athleticism and part of it's the response to the athleticism.
That's how you sell this game, is with emotion.
I'm with you.
Yeah. All right. That's that. After this, I'm going to step out. But Dave, you are going to talk to Dave Cameron. Send my best, Dave. Tell him I wish I could have been.
I will.
After this, Bennickson Smith with Dave Cameron on At the Letters.
I left your house this morning at a quarter after nine. Could have been the Willie Nelson. Could have been the one. When I left your house this morning, it was a little after nine. It was in Bob Cajun. I saw the constellations reveal themselves one star.
We are back on At the Letters and joined by Dave Cameron of FanGraphs, one of the great reads online, and someone who offers a lot of insight all around the league. But we want to talk to Dave about the Blue Jays. So let's get right to it, Dave, and let's start with Troy Tulowitzki. I mean, this guy is someone who has so much of a track record, and yet he's not hitting. What do you make of what you've seen from him so far this year?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would be a little worried about Tulowitzki. I actually wrote a post a couple weeks ago and kind of broke down one of the big red flags that I see, which is basically in-zone contact, right? So on FanGraphs, we actually track the types of swings hitters swing at, or the types of pitches they swing at, whether it's in the zone or out of the zone. And, you know, historically, in-zone contact is one of those things that you can pick up on pretty early. Like, you know, guys like Chris Davis, you know, they swing and miss at a lot of pitches in the zone because they're trying to hit for a lot of power. And then you have, you know, the Ben Reveres of the world who basically never swing and miss at pitches in the strike zone. And this is just a skill that hitters display pretty regularly, and it's something that you can pick up on pretty quickly. Tulowitzki's in-zone contact rate has been cratering over the last couple of years, and has really gone to a point now where it's limiting his ability to be a good offensive player, or to be what he was previously. So I think when you look at a guy who doesn't have, you know, Jose Bautista or Edwin Encarnacion power, a lot of Tulowitzki's game in Colorado is based around not striking out, and now he's a guy who strikes out. And so I think that's a real problem, and I think, you know, Toronto fans probably need to revise their expectations for what Tulo is. And he's not going to be the superstar that he was in Colorado, most likely. Now he's probably a good defensive shortstop who hits well enough to stay in the lineup, but probably isn't going to be, you know, an offensive force.
Yeah, and you end that piece by saying that there's a good chance that Troy Tulowitzki's days as an elite player are probably gone forever, which I think to a lot of Blue Jays fans is pretty shocking, less than 1 year after he even arrived in Toronto. So what do you think is a realistic expectation offensively for him?
I think probably as a league average hitter, I would look at him and say, you know, maybe you would think that he's probably not going to be that different offensively going forward than like Michael Saunders, who also strikes out a decent amount. And as we're seeing right now, Michael Saunders is on a good run. He's hitting for a lot of power. you know, Toronto fans have to be really excited about Michael Saunders. This is still in there for Tulowitzki. He can have months like what Saunders had the first 2 months of the season, and he can have stretches like that, but you're going to probably expect Saunders to kind of come back closer to being a league average hitter when he's healthy, and I think that's kind of what you should expect from Tulowitzki. I think the two of them should be viewed as probably comparable offensive players going forward.
That makes some sense, and probably is somewhat reassuring for Blue Jays fans who have watched Saunders get off to this great start. But one of the Jays who has struggled probably as much as Tulowitzki, probably more than Tulowitzki, in fact, would be Russell Martin. And when you look at this guy who hit 23 home runs, I think, last year, he now has one extra base hit, and we are almost 2 months of the way through the season. So what do you make of this?
I mean, I think he has to be hurt, right? Like, we talked about the neck thing, and he's playing through pain. Like, this has to be affecting him significantly more than he's letting on, to the point where if the Blue Jays had major league catching depth, they should probably put him on the disabled list. Like, it seems pretty clear that when you have one extra base hit in 2 months coming off of what he did last year and his recent established talent levels, there's just no way he's healthy.
Yeah, I think that definitely early in the year, like, he was battling that neck soreness, and at that point, I think he was striking out in almost half of his at-bats. I guess one of those, when something jumps out like that, where a player is striking out way more or way less, I mean, is that an indication that something's going on for you?
Yeah, I mean, strikeouts are one of the things that you can definitely look at as an early indicator of a significant change, because strikeouts are one of the things that batters have kind of the most control over and can stabilize a lot faster than, say, batting average or, you know, even on-base percentage. And I think when you combine a 50% strikeout rate, or I guess it's down to 33% now, which is still shockingly high for Russell Martin, with no power whatsoever, it suggests that, like, it's not like he's traded strikeouts for power, right? He's not going the Chris Davis route. He's just unable to hit the ball and hit the ball hard. And so if I was the Blue Jays at this point, I would probably be scouring the market looking for some reasonable short-term catcher who I trusted for a month or two and say, you know, Russ, we need you to get healthy and we will see you in July.
Yeah, when Josh Tolley is an offensive upgrade, rarely a good sign for your team.
Not a great thing.
Yeah, exactly. On the pitching side of things, I mean, the Blue Jays, for the most part, have been pretty good, but the bullpen has been a disappointment. And I think with the exception of Roberto Osuna and a couple of guys who really should have been their sixth and seventh relievers in the bullpen, there have been a lot of disappointments, probably none greater than Drew Storen, who has an ERA of 7.8, and he's allowed four home runs already. Now, this is where it gets interesting, because it is a small sample, but the velocity's down. What do you make of what you've seen from Drew Storen this year?
Yeah, but I think that he's probably another guy you'd look at and say, okay, with this structural change of his velocity going from 94 to 92, he was never like a guy with dominant secondary stuff. He needs a good fastball in order to be a really good reliever. So you have to kind of, like Tulowitzki, adjust your expectations down, but also say there's enough there to think that he's going to be significantly better than he's been. I mean, when you look at a guy who's giving up, what, 2.5 home runs per 9 innings, that's unsustainable even for you and me if we were pitching in the big leagues. Like, that's just not going to continue.
You're giving me too much credit.
Well, okay. Well, maybe for me then. I think realistically, you look at it, his strikeouts are still there. He's not walking guys. Commanding the strike zone is most of the game. And I think it's not that different from when the Blue Jays got Marco Estrada a couple of years ago from the Brewers. This was a guy who gave up a ton of home runs in Milwaukee and kind of had fringy stuff. And the Blue Jays were kind of able to take advantage of that and say, look, this is a guy the league basically doesn't value at all. You know, there was a chance he was going to get non-tendered if the Blue Jays didn't trade for him, and the Brewers basically just didn't want him back and because of his home run problem. And it's very easy to look at a guy who doesn't have great stuff that's giving up home runs and say, this guy's garbage, he shouldn't even be on a big league roster. The Blue Jays saw beyond that and said, look, this guy gets infield flies, this guy still throws strikes, he can be a good innings leader for us, and obviously they're very happy with what they've gotten over the last couple of years. So I would be careful to not throw Drew Storen out the window after giving up four home runs in 15 innings. Home runs are variable, and, you know, it doesn't take a lot for, you know, one ball that goes 380 feet to end up going 370 instead and the home run to be an out, and then all of a sudden you look fine.
Yeah, so I guess maybe if he becomes a league average reliever or a little bit better than that, you still have something valuable, and the free agent market last year would certainly suggest that the league as a whole values league average relievers. Would that be a realistic kind of landing place for Drew Storen for the rest of this year?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I think if you look at it and say, okay, this is probably not a guy one on the mound in a one-run game, because he doesn't have a home run problem. I mean, I think we can say even if he's not going to give up 2.5 home runs for 9 innings, like, this is a guy who's going to give up the long ball sometimes. So maybe I really only want him in there when I have a 2 or 3 run lead, and, like, one home run isn't going to cost me the game. And then if I put the couple guys on, I can get him out of there before he gives up the game-tying 3-run homer. So I think you probably look at him as, like, a 6th, 7th inning guy now instead of your 8th inning guy. But you still need 6th, 7th inning guys, and I think I wouldn't be so quick to just throw Drew Storen overboard and say, this guy can't help us in any role. I think if you look at him and say, he could be the first reliever out of the bullpen for us down the stretch, you know, and he can pitch a middle innings if a guy goes short, there's probably still value in Drew Storen.
Yeah, and you mentioned Marco Estrada earlier. I think he'd probably be one of the guys on the positive side of the ledger for a Blue Jays team that's mostly been disappointing, but you look at a regression candidate if there ever was one after posting a 3.13 ERA last year and getting Cy Young votes. I mean, I think everyone expected him to take a step back, and yet his ERA is lower. He's pitching lots of innings. He's been good. So what are you seeing from Estrada?
Yeah, I think the fun thing with Estrada is he's basically been a guy who, over the last couple seasons, kind of lived on weak contact. I think last year he posted the lowest strikeout rate of his career, which is not generally a great sign for a guy in his 30s. And he basically said, you know, I'm going to get by getting guys to hit the ball weakly to my defenders. And that's a very thin line to walk. And this year, Marco Estrada is striking guys out again. So he has a 32-year-old whose strikeout rate has gone from 18% to 24%. His ground ball rate is up, which is surprising. Estrada has been an extreme fly ball guy, one of the most extreme fly ball guys in baseball. So for him to add strikeouts and ground balls in his 30s, not something we see very regularly. So he's gone from being a guy who really relied on hitters mishitting his pitches to now he's actually making them swing and miss occasionally, and he's commanding the zone better. And so this version of Estrada actually looks better to me than the version the Blue Jays had last year.
Wow. Not bad for $26 million over 2 years, it looks like.
Yeah.
When you look a little lower in that rotation, you get to Aaron Sanchez. And this time last year, after 9 starts, Sanchez had 34 walks against 34 strikeouts. And now he's got 52 strikeouts against 21 walks. So that suggests a guy who's taken a big step forward. Do you think that what we've seen from Sanchez so far with a 3.20 ERA, lots of innings, is that sustainable to you based on what you see in the peripherals?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at a guy with a near the top of the chart ground ball rate, I think he's almost at 60%, which is, you know, almost the best in baseball in terms of getting ground balls as a starting pitcher. And then league average strikeouts on top of that, you can have kind of shaky command if you're getting elite number of ground balls and an average number of strikeouts. Obviously, Sanchez's command isn't there every start. He still has some games where he walks a bunch of guys. But I think the improvement... I was a Sanchez skeptic going into the season, but I think at this point the improvement has to be real enough where you say, look, this could be a quality major league pitcher. I'm still not convinced the command is good enough for him to be an ace. I don't think he's going to surpass Marcus Stroman anytime soon. I think he's going to settle in as more of a mid-rotation starter. And I think the innings limit question is fascinating, where they've already basically said from before the season that at some point during the year they're going to move Sanchez to the bullpen. And, with the bullpen struggling, you have to wonder – how are you going to do that with Sanchez pitching this well?
Yeah, I think that is one of the bigger questions, and the bullpen as a whole, I think is such a weakness when you look at guys like Jurado and Pat Venditti being in there, and Cecil being hurt, and Storen struggling, and Chavez now struggling, that a lot of people are looking ahead to the trade deadline as a time, assuming the Blue Jays are in it, that they could add a reliever or two. Do you think that that's potentially realistic for this club?
Yeah, I mean, I would think they're definitely going to add pitching. I'm just not 100% convinced it's going to be a reliever. Because if you're thinking you're going to limit Sanchez's innings anyway, so you might be moving him to the bullpen in August, then all of a sudden he might be your reliever that you're adding.
Yeah.
And if you say you think Storen's going to come around, maybe you add like a minor piece, like a lefty to replace Cecil. But hopefully, you know, I mean, we saw him, he was terrible in the first half last year and really good in the second half, or amazing in the second half. So you're not giving up on Brett Cecil either. So you kind of think, like, hey, look, in the second half of the season, I might be adding in a healthy Brett Cecil. I might be adding in Aaron Sanchez. I have Osuna. I think Storen could be okay-ish in the sixth or seventh inning. Like, I don't think the bullpen's as big a disaster where you want to go trade for two guys and all of a sudden you're, you know, shoving Jesse Chavez out of a role when he's still a useful pitcher. So I think they might actually be better off trading for a starting pitcher if they're going to move Sanchez to the bullpen. Now, I think as well as Sanchez is pitching, this is going to test that resolve, and they might just say, let's just leave Sanchez in the rotation and trade for a reliever. That's one way to go, too. But if they're serious about limiting Sanchez's innings, maybe you trade for a starting pitcher instead.
Yeah, that's a very interesting thought. And I think that when you look around, and I know I love trade talks. You obviously write a lot about trades as well. And yeah, it's getting to that point in the year where you can realistically kind of survey the market. And I'm seeing Rich Hill, who looks fantastic, and not a whole lot else, when the White Sox could be in on these guys, the Red Sox, the Giants. I mean, there are a lot of contending teams that could potentially look to add a starter. So to me, at least, it looks like a seller's market at this point.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, there's definitely not a lot of teams that have a lot of good starting pitching to trade. I do think there's probably a few names that will be on the market that maybe people wouldn't consider, because generally when people talk about trade targets, they generally just look at who's going to be a free agent next winter. Those are the guys who get traded, the guys in the last year of their contract. But I do think that there are teams who are in the rebuilding process who might say, you know what, this is a good time for us to take advantage of this seller's market. The fact that there's no competition, we can get a higher price for our guy who's under team control. So I think like the Braves could probably be talked into trading Julio Teheran.
Right.
And this is, you know, the kind of guy that I think would appeal to the Blue Jays. It doesn't cost a lot of money, under control for multiple years. Like, if they're going to be unloading the farm system, I don't think Mark Shapiro is going to do it for a rental, given what they did with David Price last year. But I think they could say, hey, look, maybe we can give up some of our better young pieces if we're getting a guy who can not only help us for this year, but can help us the next 2, 3, 4 years.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought, too. And you could look at teams like the Padres. Maybe if James Shields goes to the Red Sox, say, then you have one less buyer involved, and things can even out, too, as teams fall out of the race. But it's going to be interesting this summer. And I think the Blue Jays as a team are potentially at a crossroads. I mean, you kind of expect that they're going to be in contention, but what kind of time frame would you expect them to look at as far as deciding how to approach the trade deadline? Is that something that they're going to go right down to the wire for, or do you think it could happen earlier in the summer?
Yeah, I think this kind of team, I think it would have to be like a July 25th decision or something like that, like basically a week before the deadline. If they're going to like flip and talk about selling, and then at that point you're taking offers on Batista and Encarnacion, as like two huge bats that you could get a lot for. I don't think you're doing that until you're absolutely convinced that you can't come back. And I think the trick is the American League East. The Red Sox look really good right now, but their pitching depth is questionable, and their guys are not going to keep hitting this well all season long. So if you think the Red Sox aren't going to just absolutely run away with the division, you know, I don't think that being 7 games back in May is really the end of the world. And so if they get into July and they're, you know, even 5 games back, and plus with the wild card and kind of the mediocrity of the American League, it's not that hard to say, look, we're at 500. We saw what we did last year. We can make a run. We've got too much invested in these guys in order to give up now. I think they would have to be 10 plus games out in the division and maybe like fourth or fifth in line for a wild card spot to really consider, okay, maybe it's time to say this isn't our year.
Yeah, I would agree with that for sure. I don't think that Jackie Bradley Jr. is necessarily a 1,000 OPS player, as fun as it is to watch him right now. But I do tend to agree with you that the Red Sox are a really good team, probably the best team in the East from what we've seen so far. How do you see the rest of the East lining up at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Red Sox, to me, look like the best team in the division. I thought that even before the season, so this isn't necessarily just, you know, reacting to the first 6 weeks of the season. I think Boston's the best team in that division, and the fact that they have a nice lead makes them the easy favorites to win the division for me. After that, I think everyone else is pretty clustered. I think, like, now the Rays might be the worst team in the division going forward now that they've lost Kevin Kiermaier. It's a huge blow to them, and Chris Archer is struggling. And so I think Tampa, I would say, I'm less concerned about maybe than I was before the season. I think they're going to end up probably being sellers at the deadline, or at least not buyers. So then I think you look at the Yankees, who have clawed back to 500. People keep, you know, trying to kind of bury their season, but this is still a decent team. I think they're going to hang around. I don't think the Yankees are going to be sellers necessarily. I don't know if they're going to be buyers either, but I think they're going to hang around the 500 mark and maybe hang around the wild card race. Baltimore is really the interesting team that I think is kind of the team for Toronto to have to vault over. Obviously, they're playing really well right now. But a lot of that is, you know, Mark Trumbo having the best year of his career.
Yeah.
And I don't know that you want to bank your playoff odds on Mark Trumbo. I still think the Orioles pitching staff has a lot of question marks, probably more than the Blue Jays do. They're relying very heavily on Zach Britton and Darren O'Day in their bullpen. So if either one of those guys goes down, the Orioles, I think, would be in a lot of trouble. So I think you basically have one really good team at the top of this division. And I think the Blue Jays can hurdle every team but that. And then if, you know, trouble strikes the Red Sox, I don't think they're it's impossible to catch them either.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. Dave, really appreciate the time. We will be sure to read you on Fangraphs and follow you on Twitter at DCameronFG. Thanks again. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks, man.
That's it for this week on At the Letters. Thanks to Arden Swelling. Thanks to Dave Cameron. And thanks to our producer, Sam McKee. You can follow Arden on Twitter at Arden Swelling. Dave is on Twitter at DCameronFG. Sam is on Twitter at Sam A. McKee, and I'm at B. Nicholson Smith. In the meantime, be sure to go to iTunes where you can rate and review the podcast. Ratings, reviews, always welcome. And you can find us, of course, at sportsnet.ca as well. Thanks for listening. We're at the Letters.
Time and place now lost.